Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 37, A Silence Closely Resembling Stupidity. Readings from Eduardo Galeano's book Open Veins of Latin America, 5 Centuries of the Pillage of a Continent. It's a translated edition, first published in 1973, the Spanish edition 1971, Las Venas Abiertas de América Latina. In the foreword, Isabel Allende writes, Eduardo Galeano has also published several works of fiction and poetry. He is the author of innumerable articles, interviews, and lectures. He has obtained many awards, honorary degrees, and recognition for his literary talent and his political activism. He is one of the most interesting authors ever to come out of Latin America, a region known for its great literary names. His work is a mixture of meticulous detail, political conviction, poetic flair, and good storytelling. He has walked up and down Latin America, listening to the voices of the poor and the oppressed, as well as those of the leaders and intellectuals. He has lived with Indians, peasants, guerrillas, soldiers, artists, and outlaws. He has talked to presidents, tyrants, martyrs, priests, heroes, bandits, desperate mothers, and patient prostitutes. He has suffered tropical fevers, walked in the jungle, and survived a massive heart attack. He has been persecuted by repressive regimes as well as by fanatical terrorists. He has opposed military dictatorships and all forms of brutality and exploitation, taking unthinkable risks in defense of human rights. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. And finishing up that section of the foreword, Galeano has more first-hand knowledge of Latin America than anybody else I can think of and uses it to tell the world of the dreams and disillusions, the hopes and the failures of its people. He is an adventurer with a talent for writing, a compassionate heart, and a soft sense of humor. Two-part show, because there's just so much good stuff to get to, so much information, and it's kind of like Dickens. It was the best of times, the worst of times. This book is just one of the most powerful, eloquently written, eye-opening, fascinating books, and in that sense, the best of times and then the worst of times, because it clearly delineates the atrocities, the rigged system, the oligarchy or oiligarchy, the resource oligarchy that has, as the title says, pillaged the continent, which is now starting to repair itself with the likes of Morales and Correa and the work that Chavez began and so on. So before reading some of the text, just want to describe some of my connection with this book, because it's, people say they read a book that changes their lives. A lot of times we grow up with that sort of the novel that we relate to and the character that you know, changes our life kind of thing. And this also probably a part two, because I still got about 40 pages left in the book. And it's a very dense book. Powerfulness of the book. When I first read a few pages online, I had this experience. I'll try to describe it, because it was like a heart opening. If you're familiar with the chakras, it was like this heart opening experience where I just felt this sort of compassion, sadness, such a depth of feeling at reading a few pages that to me it was a sign of, I just have to read this book. If it is moving me so deeply, then I have to read it. And that's pretty much how the book reads. Sometimes there's a sadness, there's also a sense of, you know, outrage, and also kind of a sharpening of sort of a fierceness of remembering the stuff as a way to stay in tune with the, I guess I'll call it the rigged system, and how much of stuff has been like that for so long, and that we're just coming out of it, really, as again, with all the protest movements and the countries, and especially in Latin America, taking control of their own resources and improving things. So the book came out in 1973, and it's one of those books, boy, if I had read it then, what I would know now. Some of the stuff is eerie in a way. I guess certain truths are just basically timeless. Towards the back, just read a passage that is like a blueprint for what's going on, and what has gone on with the war on terror. Here's the passage. In difficult times, democracy becomes a crime against national security. Democracy becomes a crime against national security, that is, against the security of internal privilege and foreign investment. Our devices for mincing human flesh are part of an international machinery. The whole society is militarized. The state of exception is made permanent, and the repressive apparatus is endowed with hegemony by the turn of a screw in the centers of the imperial system. When crisis begins to throw its shadow, the pillage of poor countries must be intensified to guarantee full employment, public liberties, and high rates of development in rich countries. This book, it evokes the real raw emotions, as well as the history of raw materials and how they connect with the infrastructure. This is a book that Chavez gave to Obama in 2009. So whether he's read it or not, I don't know. But it certainly shows that, you know, you can, as an artist, you can write something astoundingly wonderful, and depends on the reader. It could have no effect on the reader. So that's something, as an artist, I think one must Buddhistly, unattachedly accept that. You could write the greatest book ever, but, you know, someone is only in a place where they're at as to whether they're going to hear it or not. The opening quote, from whence the title of the, presumably part one, because I don't know how long this is going to take. This comes at the beginning of the book, from the Revolutionary Proclamation of the Junta Tuitiva La Paz, July 16th, 1809. We have maintained a silence closely resembling stupidity. We have maintained a silence closely resembling stupidity. And some of the first sections of the book, actually the introduction by Eduardo Galeano, is beautifully eloquent and touches on writing and what the role of the writer is, and how that relates to one's country, one's purpose in life. It touches on a lot. So it's called In Defense of the Word. One writes out of a need to communicate and to commune with others, to denounce that which gives pain and to share that which gives happiness. One writes against one's solitude and against the solitude of others. One assumes that literature transmits knowledge and affects the behavior and language of those who read. One writes in reality for the people whose luck or misfortune one identifies with. The hungry, the sleepless, the rebels, and the wretched of this earth, and majority of them are illiterate. How can those of us who want to work for a literature that helps to make audible the voice of the voiceless function in the context of this reality, can we make ourselves heard in the midst of a deaf-mute culture? The small freedom conceded to writers, is it not at times a proof of our failure? How far can we go? Whom can we reach? To awaken consciousness, to reveal identity, can literature claim a better function in these times, in these lands? Our own fate as Latin American writers is linked to the need for profound social transformations. To narrate is to give oneself. It seems obvious that literature, as an effort to communicate fully, will continue to be blocked, so long as misery and illiteracy exist, and so long as the possessors of power continue to carry on with impunity their policy of collective imbecilization through the mass media. Great changes, deep structural changes, will be necessary in our countries if we writers are to go beyond the elites, if we are to express ourselves. In an incarcerated society, free literature can exist only as denunciation and hope. We are what we do, especially what we do to change what we are. In this respect, a, quote, revolutionary, end quote, literature written for the convinced is just as much an abandonment as is a conservative literature devoted to the contemplation of one's own navel. Our effectiveness depends on our capacity to be audacious and astute, clear and appealing. I would hope that we can create a language more fearless and beautiful than that used by conformist writers to greet the twilight. In Latin America, a literature is taking shape and acquiring strength, a literature that does not propose to bury our dead, but to immortalize them, that refuses to stir the ashes, but rather attempts to light the fire. Perhaps it may help to preserve for the generations to come the true name of all things. And that was in 1978 from Days and Nights of Love and War, a book, 1983. Maybe that's an article reprinted from Monthly Review Press. Reminded of Hugo Chavez reading that he gave out copies of The Man of La Mancha and that the Venezuelan's literacy rate is intensely improved. So, you know, a political leader in giving people books and helping them become more literate, you know, have we heard of that in the West? And a couple of paragraphs to the introduction. Again, some of the eloquence shows. Introduction, 120 million children in the eye of the hurricane. The division of labor among nations is that some specialize in winning and others in losing. Our part of the world, known today as Latin America, was precocious. It has specialized in losing ever since those remote times when Renaissance Europeans ventured across the ocean and buried their teeth in the throats of the Indian civilizations. Centuries passed, and Latin America perfected its role. We are no longer in the era of marvels, when fact surpassed fable and imagination was shamed by the trophies of conquest, the loads of gold, the mountains of silver. But our region still works as a menial. It continues to exist at the service of others' needs as a source and reserve of oil and iron, of copper and meat, of fruit and coffee, the raw materials and foods destined for rich countries which profit more from consuming them than Latin America does from producing them. The taxes collected by the buyers are much higher than the prices received by the sellers. And after all, as Alliance for Progress coordinator Covey T. Oliver said in July 1968, to speak of fair prices is a, quote, medieval, unquote, concept. For we are in the era of free trade. Another paragraph. Latin America is the region of open veins. Everything from the discovery until our times has always been transmuted into European or later United States capital, and as such has accumulated in distant centers of power. Everything, the soil, its fruits and its mineral-rich depths, the people and their capacity to work and to consume, natural resources and human resources. Production methods and class structure have been successfully determined from outside for each area by meshing it into the universal gearbox of capitalism. To each area has been assigned a function, always for the benefit of the foreign metropolis of the moment, and the endless chain of dependency has been endlessly extended. The chain has been more than two links. in Latin America also includes the oppression of small countries by their larger neighbors and, within each country's frontiers, the exploitation by big cities and ports of their internal sources of food and labor. 4 centuries ago, 16 of today's 20 biggest Latin American cities already existed. He gives examples of how, ports are designed and resources are extracted, and so infrastructure is developed to accommodate the global corporate empire rather than help the locals. And so it seems that's that illusion of progress where, look, we have traffic, we have ports, but the effects on the countries that we hardly ever hear of. So that is the importance of this book. And also, it's just so beautifully written in English. It's amazing to realize that it was translated by Cedric Belfrage, or Frage, B-E-L-F-R-A-G-E. So again, an astounding book. Foreword is by Isabel Allende. It's a difficult book. It's hard to read, especially if you haven't been aware of this topic. I mean, I first got into this theme learning about Native America and the pillaging there. So extending it to Latin America was part of my eye-opener with this book, and showed me how, it was really across the American board, so to speak. And it's also a difficult book to read in the sense that I would read a paragraph or a couple of pages, and it's so dense with information and emotional impact that a lot of times I just put it down after, a page or two. So I don't remember when I started it. It seems like it's been a year or two. A nice thing about that is there are lots of little sections, so it gives you a sense of, kind of a built-in structure to it. So again, it's the best of times, the worst of times. It's a wonderfully written book. You can learn a lot, but it is a difficult read in, both an emotional and informational way. Other notes that I have reading along is the sense of monoculture, the stripping of areas and fast, large production of one crop at the expense of others, the slaves and slave labor, the emphasis on exports. There'll be some references in the citations here, whether it's gold, sugar, rubber, cacao, oil, coffee, cotton, bananas. It's basically, like he says, everything, you name it, all coming from the Mother Earth, all coming out of this in mostly indigenous labor. Another part of the eye-opener of this book for me, it helped me see clearly what I already felt and knew was, in a sense, the whole system being rigged, the whole system being, in a way, an illusion. What the Buddhists and Hindus call the Mahamaya, the great illusion, this trap of materiality. And, an example I like to give is not to diminish, say, the fine craftsmanship of a beautiful piece of furniture that was crafted in Europe in whatever, 1700s or whatever, and somebody enjoys that and it's beautiful. But to realize that, basically everything, and I'm saying that in quotes because I don't know that it's everything, but reading this book, it sure comes across that way. Virtually everything has come from, on the back or in some way, a bit of tainting from this system, this 500-year system. So it's that, again, is what I meant by a fierceness. It kind of honed in my sense of being able to simplify this stuff, even though it's a complex topic. And again, to put the light and the positive spin on it, it really seems like, looking at the world news nowadays, that we're coming out of this pillaging cycle, or in a way, it's the battle to get out of it. And, many of these battles going on a lot even in the U.S. with the Native Americans on the front lines, protecting their lands, protecting the resources. The XL pipeline, most notably now with natives and non-native allies, is bringing people together to say, look, enough is enough. Just to give you a sense of the where the book goes, the official contents, chapter sections, part one, mankind's poverty as a consequence of the wealth of the land. Lust for gold, lust for silver, king sugar and other agricultural monarchs, the invisible sources of power, Part 2, development is a voyage with more shipwrecks than navigators, tales of premature death, the contemporary structure of plunder. And Part 3 is 7 years after. That's after his first writing of the book. And there's tons of references in the book. So I'm just going to leaf through, pick out a few lines that I have underlined, and then go to some other sections, specific sections. There's a quote, "The sword and the cross marched together in the conquest and plunder of Latin America," a reference to the church and Columbus type of mentality. "In the mid-17th century, silver constituted more than 99% of mineral exports from Spanish America." Talking about a city, Potosi, P-O-T-O-S-I, with an accent. "In our time, Potosi is a poor city in a poor Bolivia, the city which has given most to the world and has the least, as an old Potosian lady enveloped in a mile of alpaca shawl told me when we talked on the Andalusian patio of her two-century-old house." Again, the writing is eloquent. "The man sat beside me in silence. The strong noonday light outlined his sharp-nosed, high-cheekboned profile. We had left the southern frontier bound for Asunción in a bus for 20 persons, which by some alchemy contained 50. There was a halt after a few hours. We sat in an open patio under the shade of thick leaves. Before us stretched the blinding brilliance of the red earth, immense, unpopulated, untouched. From horizon to horizon, nothing disturbed the transparency of the Paraguayan air. We smoked. My companion, a Guarani-speaking peasant, strung together a few sad words in Spanish. We Paraguayans are poor and few. He explained that he'd gone down to Encarnacion to look for work, but had found none. He'd managed to scrape up some pesos for the fare home. Years earlier, as a child, he'd tried his fortune in Buenos Aires in southern Brazil. Now it was cotton-picking time, and many Paraguayan braceros were taking off as they did every year for Argentina. But I'm 63, all that crowd going after the jobs." And, he'll follow something that's like a novel, eloquent writing, up with a bunch of, you know, facts and quotes. So, again, it's quite an interesting genre approach. It's a mix of, mix of style of writing, history in an engaging way. Personally, you know, a lot of history books that are dry, I find hard to do, but this is really always connected with the people. And here's another section referring to what's talked about in with the Native Americans and the taking over of land. "The past, 400 years after the papal bull in September 1957, the highest court in Paraguay published a notice informing all the judges of the country that, quote, the Indians, like other inhabitants of the Republic, are human beings," end quote. And the Center for Anthropological Studies of the Catholic University of Asunción later carried out a revealing survey, both in the capital and in the countryside. 8 out of 10 Paraguayans think that, quote, Indians are animals, end quote. "On the Pacific coast, the Spaniards destroyed or let die out the enormous plantations of corn, yucca, kidney and white beans, peanuts and sweet potato. The desert quickly devoured great tracts of land which the Inca irrigation network had made abundant. 4.5 centuries after the conquest, only rocks and briars remain where roads had once united an empire. Although the Incas' great public works were for the most part destroyed by time or the usurper's hand, one may still see across the Andean Cordillera traces of the endless terraces which permitted and still permit cultivation of the mountainsides. A U.S. technician estimated in 1936 that if the Inca terraces had been built by modern methods at 1936 wage rates, they would have cost some $30,000 per acre. In that empire which did not know the wheel, the horse, or iron, the terraces and aqueducts were made possible by prodigious organization and technical perfection achieved through wise distribution of labor as well as the religious force that ruled man's relation with the soil, which was sacred and thus always alive. Exiled in their own land, condemned to an external exodus, Latin America's native people were pushed into the poorest areas, arid mountains, the middle of deserts, as the dominant civilization extended its frontiers. The Indians have suffered and continue to suffer the curse of their own wealth. That is the drama of all Latin America. When placer gold was discovered in Nicaragua's Rio Blue fields, the Carca Indians were quickly expelled far from the riparian lands, and the same happened with the Indians in all the fertile valleys and rich subsoil lands south of the Rio Grande. The massacres of Indians that began with Columbus never stopped. In Uruguay and Argentine Patagonia, they were exterminated during the last century by troops that hunted them down and penned them in forests or in the deserts so that they might not disturb the organized advance of cattle, latifundia. The latifundia is kind of like a sort of plantation type of thing. The Yaqui Indians of the Mexican state of Sonora were drowned in blood so that their lands, fertile and rich in minerals, could be sold without any unpleasantness to various U.S. capitalists. Survivors were deported to plantations in Yucatan, and the Yucatan Peninsula became not only the cemetery of the Mayas, who had been its owners, but also of the Yaquis who came from afar. At the beginning of our century, the 50 kings of Henequen had more than 100,000 Indian slaves on their plantations. Despite the exceptional physical endurance of the strapping, handsome Yaquis, two-thirds of them died during the first year of slave labor. In our day, Henequen can compare with synthetic fiber substitutes only because of the workers' abysmally low standard of living. Things have certainly changed, but not as much, at least for the natives of Yucatan, as some believe. The living conditions of these workers are much like slave labor, says one contemporary authority. On the Andean slopes near Bogota, the Indian peon must still give a day's work without pay to get the hacendado's permission to farm his own plot on moonlit nights. As René Dumont says, this Indian's ancestors, answering to no man, used once to cultivate the rich soil of the ownerless plain. Now he works for nothing to gain the right to cultivate the poor slopes of the mountain. Not even Indians isolated in the depths of the forests are safe in our day. At the beginning of this century, 230 tribes survived in Brazil. Since then, 90 have disappeared, erased from the planet by firearms and microbes. Violence and disease, the advance guard of civilization. For the Indian, contact with the white men continues to be contact with death. Every legal dispensation since 1537 meant to protect Brazil's Indians has been turned against them. Under Brazilian constitution, they are the original and natural masters of the land they occupy, but the richer that virgin land proves to be, the greater the threat hanging over their lives. Nature's very generosity makes them targets of plunder and crime. Indian hunting has become ferocious in recent years. The world's greatest forest, a tropical zone open to legend and adventure, has inspired a new, quote, American dream. Men and business enterprises from the United States, a new procession of conquistadores, have poured into Amazonia as if it were another far west. And into Iraq and Afghanistan, and so the empire goes. But right there, you know, you can see the depth of what that touches. And that's what I mean by read a few pages and have to pause. Another section here has to do with the rigged market, competition and price fixing. In barely 3 years, from 1959 to 1961, to give but one example, the international price of the Brazilian cacao bean fell by one-third. Since then, the tendency to rise has opened the door of hope a crack, but the United Nations Economic Commission for Latin America predicts a short life for the upward curve. To keep their chocolate cheap, the big cacao consumers, the United States, Britain, West Germany, Holland, France, stimulate competition between African cacao and cacao from Brazil and Ecuador. Controlling prices as they do, these nations bring on periods of depression which put cacao workers back on the road. The unemployed look for trees to sleep under and green bananas to fool their stomachs. One product they certainly don't eat is the fine chocolate that Brazil actually imports from France and Switzerland. Chocolate costs more and more, cacao less and less. Between 1950 and 1960, Ecuador's cacao sales rose more than 30% in volume, but only 15% in value. The remaining 15% was a gift from Ecuador to those rich countries, which in the same period sent it to their industrial products at escalating prices. Ecuador's economy depends on the sale of bananas, coffee, and cacao, three food products highly subject to price fluctuations. According to official data, 7 of every 10 Ecuadorians suffer from basic malnutrition, and the country has one of the highest death rates in the world.
And, you know, the other factual stuff is learning about, you know, what products from where cotton was cheap, Paraguay's chief export. Uruguay lost the Canadian market for its rice and the wheat of Argentina. And here's a short telling quote. With the abolition of slavery in 1888, the combined forces of feudal serfdom and wage labor that still persist was inaugurated. So, you know, we think we're past slavery and we've overcome that. But again, this book is a sort of a de-intellectualizer, a de-progressor. If you think, you know, you're part of this world that has progressed and all, and it's like, look twice. You know, it's just the way it is. It's not something to, I don't know, it's not something to struggle over, but to realize it and then come to grips with it in some way and see what you can do to help the changes. Yeah, here's the bit about the way economic changes happen, or one of the bits. On the eve of World War I, 2/3 of Chile's national income came from nitrate exports, but it was a prosperity which, far from developing and diversifying, only heightened the country's structural deformations. Chile functioned as an appendage of the British economy. The biggest supplier of fertilizer to the European market had no right to its own life. And then a German chemist sitting in his laboratory defeated the generals who had won the day on the battlefield. Perfection of the Haber process, which produces nitrates by fixing nitrogen from the air, decisively displaced Chilean nitrate and sent Chile's economy into a tailspin. So that kind of stuff I find just, you know, plain old interesting. It's like fascinating, call it trivia, but it's, you know, historical, interesting stuff. And the way that Galeano puts things in perspective, he says, toward the end of the violent decade, the United Nations published the results of a study of nutrition in Colombia, and there has been absolutely no improvement since then. 88% of Bogota school children suffer from avitaminosis, 78% from riboflavinosis, and more than half were below normal weight. Avitaminosis affected 71% of workers and 78% of Tenza Valley peasants. The study showed a marked insufficiency of protective foods, milk and its derivatives, eggs, meat, fish, and some fruits and vegetables, which together provide protein, vitamins, and salt. It is not only the flash of gunfire that reveals social tragedy. Another thing about the way change happens, this is kind of laboratory versus nature. In the section, the world market casts its spell over Central America. Central American lands were comparatively unmolested up until the middle of the past century. In addition to food, the area produced cochineal and indigo with modest capital, a meager labor force, and few worries. Both the indigo plant and the cochineal bug busily multiplying on the prickly surface of the nopal cactus were in steady demand in European textile industries, but both of these natural pigments met a synthetic death around 1850 when German chemists invented an aniline and other cheaper dyes. 30 years after this victory of the laboratory over nature, it was coffee's turn. Central America was transformed. By 1880, its newborn plantations were raising almost 1/6 of the world's coffee production. Coffee locked the region firmly into the world market. First English, then German, and finally U.S. buyers gave life to a native coffee bourgeoisie, which became the political power after the revolution led by Justo Rufino Barrios early in the 1870s. Agricultural specialization dictated from abroad set off a frenzy of land and labor grabbing. The Central American latifundio of today was born under the banner of free labor. Now, some are familiar with the bananas and the United Fruit Company, that story. I think that's Guatemala or Honduras. And imperial colonialism, with its predatory and supremacist ideology, plunders resources with slave labor. That's one of my notes trying to sum up, you know, after reading pages and pages of this. Imperial colonialism, with its predatory and supremacist ideology, plunders resources with slave labor. So again, aside from, you know, hopefully not being too depressing, these are calls to the importance of, you know, local farming, communities working together, boycotting, you know, the greedy corporations, finding out what products you like, who makes them, and making choices. You know, really, we vote with our wallets, as they say. So that is, that's an opportunity to, again, to transform the alchemy of the book of finding the stuff that's just hard to deal with and finding some way to turn it into a positive. Coarse oil, another big scam area. I don't think I'm the one that came up with the oiligarchy pun. Okay, a section, the black curse of petroleum. Along with natural gas, petroleum is today the chief fuel that keeps our world in motion. It is a raw material of rising importance for the chemical industry and is the basic strategic material for military activities. Nothing compares with this black gold as a magnet for foreign capital. Nothing earns such lush profits. No jewel in the diadem of capitalism is so monopolized that no businessmen wield the global political power of the great petroleum corporations. Standard Oil and Shell seat and unseat kings and presidents, finance palace plots and coups d'etat, have innumerable generals, ministers, and James Bonds at their command, and make decisions about peace or war in every field and every language. Standard Oil of New Jersey, now Exxon, is the capitalist world's biggest industrial enterprise. Outside the United States, no industrial enterprise has greater power than Royal Dutch Shell. Remember, this is written in 1973, so some of it may have changed. Affiliates sell crude petroleum to subsidiaries which refine it and sell it to branch organizations for distribution. There is no loss of blood in the whole internal circulatory system of the cartel, which also owns the pipelines and most of the oil fleets on the seven seas. Prices are manipulated on a world scale to keep taxes low and profits high. The crude petroleum gets constantly cheaper, the refined constantly more expensive. With petroleum, as with coffee or meat, rich countries profit more from the work of consuming it than do poor countries from the work of producing it. The ratio is 10 to 1. Of the $11 that the derivatives of a barrel of petroleum sell for, countries exporting the world's most important raw material get a sum total of $1 from taxes and extraction costs. Countries in the developed zone, where the oil companies have their head offices, get the other 10. The sum total of their own taxes, 8 times larger than those of the producing countries, and the costs and profits of transport, refining, processing, and distribution monopolized by the big corporation. I'm a golf fan, and I love to watch golf on TV, but I'm actually starting to draw the line when I see golf tournaments in Dubai, which is, you know, one of those Arab wealthy areas, I think pretty deserty. There are those golf courses. With my this global political consciousness is starting to get into where I might draw the line in my enjoyment, my few hours on a weekend to just kind of space out and enjoy the scenery. But that line too has been drawn for me. So let's see. I'll end up this part one, because again, this is not as long as some of the shows, but the amount of intensity makes it feel that way. And just to end this part one with the what I've called the summary of exploitation, because for those who don't want to read the book, if you remember anything, it's that kind of thing about the resources, the people, the exploitation, and that all is not what it seems. And enjoy your luscious chocolate bar, but at least thank, give a prayer of thanks to whoever, perhaps, with a bent back, helped produce it. And here's a little summary bit. Latin America's big ports, through which the wealth of its soil and subsoil passed en route to distant centers of power, were being built up as instruments of the conquest and domination of the countries to which they belonged, and as conduits through which to drain the nation's income. While ports and capitals strove to be like Paris or London, behind them stretched the desert. So we'll leave it at that for part one, and go out with a piece from a CD with Latin American music. Thank you very much for listening, and take care.
Cariñito, little love. This is attributed to country Colombia.